Thorpe. No matter what happens, you keep working. She'd no sooner said this than the toad burst out of the water again, this time from the other side of the tree. It opened its mouth and tried to swallow Oglethorpe, who'd just got the chain fastened around the trunk. He looked up in time and ducked away, taking shelter between the branches of the tree and shouting for help. Tolvern had more time to place her shot this time. She aimed at one of its huge eyeballs and squeezed off a shot. It hit a transparent membrane and ricocheted off. Tolvern had expected to blind it in one eye, but instead all she'd done was attract its attention. It hopped over Oglethorpe, who was still cringing among the branches, and splashed into the water in front of the others. The resulting wave swept Carvalho from his feet, and he vanished beneath the surface. Tolvern kept shooting, but the bullets may as well have been bouncing off stone. The toad squatted to leap at her again. Cap fired her hand cannon. The grenade hit the animal on the underside of its neck and detonated on impact. It roared again, this time a higher squealing sound full of pain. It went under the water, and this time when it came up, there was thick blue-red blood streaming down its throat. It took a giant leap toward the canal, fleeing, and a huge spray of mud and water lifted when it hit.
"That's right," Cap shouted.
She slammed another grenade into the hand cannon.
"You want another one? Come back and get it."
She looked around.
"Carvalho!"
He came up, sputtering. He slogged back across the road, cursing about having lost his rifle when he went under, seemingly oblivious to Cap's relief.
"Get back in the truck, everyone," O'Keefe said. "That's not the last of them."
Indeed, two more attacked in quick succession as they drove floated off a few minutes later. The first was a huge toad, even bigger than the first, which appeared suddenly ahead of them. It seized the entire truck with its powerful tongue, but before it could get its mouth around it and contend with the spikes, another, slightly smaller toad hopped out of the river to their left. It too caught the truck with its tongue, and soon the two animals were jerking it back and forth between them. Inside, the passengers shouted as the fighting tossed them about like ice in a tumbler. Finally, the big toad gave up on the truck and went after the little toad instead. The smaller toad was nearly two-thirds its size, but it soon got the thing in its mouth. The bones of the smaller one crunched, and a flailing back leg kicked the truck away. The truck rolled onto its side, but it was built like a tank and largely undamaged. Even as the larger toad was still crunching its oversized meal, the humans jumped out and used one of the spikes as a lever to flip the truck upright. They sped off before the toad looked around for dessert. Yet another toad caught them moments later, and here they learned the value of the spikes. It got the truck in its mouth, but when it tried to crush its prey, the spikes impaled its mouth. It spit them out and shook its head, bellowing in anger. Once more, they righted themselves and continued on their way. The whole experience was terrifying. But they'd emerged unharmed and were now passing through a forested stretch and relative tranquility.
"This isn't the way to the yards,"
Ortiz said a few minutes later.
"Who said anything about the yards?"
Carvalho responded.
"You did. You said I should come with you to the yards and wait it out, that there's a perimeter."
"He didn't say that, you bonehead," O'Keefe said.
"I did."
"We have a stop to make first," Tolvern said.
"How much farther?"
Carvalho consulted his computer.
"Another 1,000 yards or so, then down the road to the left. Morpho's in the middle of a field, shouldn't have to look too hard."
"I don't want anything to do with this,"
Ortiz said.
"Fine," Tolvern said. "Stop the truck, Carvalho, and let him out. Go ahead, Ortiz. I'm sure you know how to swim." "You know that's not what I mean. I didn't agree to any of these. Take me back to the city."
"Shut up, you wanker," Cap said, "or I'll throw you out myself."
Ortiz started to say something else, but Carvalho cut him off in Ladino, and that finally ended his objections. They took the road on the left, which was underwater and only identifiable by the absence of trees. The rain kept thundering down. Soon they emerged from the woods.
"It's got to be here," Carvalho said, squinting down at the viewscreen. "Where could it? Diablos!"
He hit the brakes, and they slid to a sloppy halt. There it was, Morpho, looming ahead of them. They'd very nearly run into the blasted thing. The spacecraft had sunk partway into the mud and had been misidentified on the viewscreen as a small hillock. They all tumbled out, including Ortiz, who wouldn't be left alone inside. Tolvern tried to shield her eyes and mouth from the water, but the rain was coming down so hard that it felt like she was drowning. She muttered an oath as she took in the ship.
"How the devil are we going to get inside?"
"She ain't got much armor," Cap said. She patted her hand cannon. "How about this old beauty?"
"Don't be ridiculous. She's got enough to deflect high-velocity space debris. There's no way a grenade or two will do the trick. Oglethorpe, see if you can raise Blackbeard or the Yards. Tell them our predicament."
"There's a plasma torch at the foundry that'll cut through the skin," O'Keefe said.
"Don't do us much good here, do it?" Cap said. "And I don't fancy going back for it and facing them toads again."
"Comlink's still down, sir," Oglethorpe said.
Ortiz had sloshed ahead, muttering in Ladino, and Tolvern could still hear him, though he'd vanished into the rain, like a man walking through a waterfall. She caught a glimpse of movement along the hulking form of the spacecraft as he made his way around it.
"Or you could go in through the open door," he called back.
They hurried up to where he stood, next to the ship. Sure enough, the bay doors were open, rain pouring into an empty cargo space. A loading ramp extended down and disappeared into the water. Tolvern kicked around in the water until she found the edge.
"Everyone armed? Good, let's go."
They made their way up the ramp and into a cargo space about 35 feet long and 15 feet wide. Water was already lapping nearly to the opening, and if it rose another few inches, it would start to flood the cargo bay. Worse than that, Tolvern realized as she looked around. The airlock leading from the cargo area into the rest of the ship was also open. Once water rose into the bay, it would stream into the rest of the ship, maybe all the way to the electronics and engine room. Crew quarters bridge, too. The others looked to Tolvern for guidance, and she nodded and gestured toward the open airlock. Ortiz had come in with them, but now tried to slink back outside. O'Keefe and Cap collared him.
"Oh, no you don't, you coward," O'Keefe said in a low voice. "Someone give this tosser a weapon," Cap said. "If it comes to shooting, you can do your job, mate."
Carvalho slapped the pistol into Ortiz's hands and glared, as if daring him to run off or use the weapon to bluster his way free.
"Fine," Ortiz said irritably, "but don't think this changes anything."
The hot, humid air of San Borondón's climate gave way to a stench of sweat, vomit, and urine as they made their way across the cargo bay and into the passageways on the other side. Partially empty ration containers lay rotting on the floor, and they came upon a place where someone had loosed his bowels in the hallway. There was strangely sweet scent mixed in with the stench.
"Ugh," Cap said, her face scrunched up. "Smells like someone took a shite on a birthday cake."
The corridor branched in two. Tolvern held Oglethorpe and the still-reluctant Ortiz at the juncture, then brought the other three along with her toward the bridge on her left. They reached it moments later, only to find it empty. More filth here, the rubbish ankle-deep, half-empty tubes of peanut butter paste, meat sauce spilling from packets and going rancid, an overturned bin of wheat kernels, like someone had been eating it raw. Dried vomit sprayed the console at the captain's chair. Gobs of what looked like mashed-up slug slime splattered the floor.
"Don't touch anything," Tolvern said.
"Hell no," Cap said. "You don't think we're going to get the plague of the sweaty dance or nothing?"
"Not unless the buzzards show up and spit up in your face.
How you know they ain't here already?"
The captain didn't know, now that she thought about it. The four of them didn't linger on the bridge, but went back to where Oglethorpe and Ortiz were still waiting. They cautiously took a jog in the corridor, went past the empty mess hall, itself filthy with food and other waste, by a bathroom that was beyond disgusting, and into the living quarters. There were only two rooms. The first had a single bunk, and here they found one of the two fugitives. It was Dijkstra, the one who'd led them to the kettle system to look for the Singaporeans. He lay motionless on the bunk, face pale and waxy, apparently dead. Befouled clothing, vomit, and more drying gobs of snot-like substance covered the floor. Tolvern's stomach heaved at the stench.
"Don't go in there, Captain," Cap said.
A trickle of nervous perspiration beaded at Tolvern's temple. No, this wasn't the plague or the sweaty dance, that illness that left people thrashing helplessly until they were soaked in sweat and dying of exhaustion. It was an even more frightening disease. But she didn't think it was communicable, not like that. Still, she remained in the corridor rather than enter and verify that Dijkstra was dead. Carvalho moved to the second room. I found the other one, Captain. It was Megat, and he was alive. This room had four bunks, and the man sat on the edge of one of them, his bare feet on the floor, right in the filth. His chest was bare, but he wore thin pajama-like trousers below. Stubble covered his face. His eyes were bloodshot. He carried no weapon, and Tolvern lowered her gun after a quick glance to make sure the room was clear. Cap, make sure the other one doesn't get up or try anything funny. I think he's dead, but we won't take chances. Aye, Captain. Carvalho and O'Keefe, I want you to position at the end of the corridor. Make sure none of the buzzards come bursting out of the ductwork.
They won't, Megat said. His voice was thick, phlegmy, like a man with a deep chest cold. The birds who boarded this ship were the spacefarers, and they can't handle the gravity on a world like this. Only the harvesters come down to high-gravity planets.
So you're admitting it? Tolvern asked. No lies about how you were running for freedom and just happened to find a starship? How you slipped through the battle undetected thanks to a lucky break or two?
Megat let out a low, bitter chuckle that became first a cough and then an unstoppable hacking that went on and on until he eventually brought up a mass of lumpy green mucus that looked like slugs mixed with green oatmeal. After spitting it to the floor, he wiped his mouth with the back of his hand and looked up at her again.
That's exactly how it started, me running for freedom. He shook his head. Dijkstra told me when he let me out that he had a ship hidden in the area and needed a co-pilot, someone with my skills. If I helped him, he'd drop me off among one of the Singaporean refugee camps on Samborondon.
What kind of idiot are you? Tolvern said. Your battle station was hidden all these years. How would Dijkstra possibly have a ship stashed nearby without your knowledge?
He had a plausible story, or semi-plausible. But also I wanted to believe. Of course it sounds ludicrous now, but I wanted it to be true, and so it was.
This Tolvern could understand. When Dijkstra came on board Blackbeard with a tale about how to contact the Singaporean battle station, she'd overlooked the obvious discrepancies in his story, how he'd claimed to be alone on a ship after leading a group of non-existent refugees, not one of whom had survived. Blackbeard was far from friendly systems, battered and desperate, and Tolvern simply wanted the story to be true.
So now you know that Dijkstra is a liar, she said.
He's a liar for a reason. And that reason is up here.
Megat tapped his head.
I'd have been a liar a few days ago, too. Too late for that now. I'm lost and done for.
He stopped and coughed again. This time the coughing went on for so long that after he'd hocked up a mass of phlegm, he bent over and puked. A thin, watery vomit came up at first, but soon it was nothing but dry heaves.
Captain, Cap called from the hallway. Time is running out.
Tolvern looked down to see a line of water creeping into the room and sloshing against her boot as the floodwater entered the open ship and continued to rise. Megat was still puking, and Tolvern tried the comlink, not expecting an answer, but Smythe came on.
Damn it, Smythe, you picked one hell of a time to bring the system down for testing.
Sorry, sir, he said. You didn't go out to Morpho by yourself, did you? There are giant toads. Some of them got into the yard somehow. Ate two of Rodriguez's crew before they could be killed.
I know all about the toads, Tolvern said impatiently. Tell Rodriguez we need one of the big trucks out here as soon as possible. The small truck is underwater, and Morpho is filling up and may just sink into the mud.
Yes, sir. Did you get the fugitives?
I'll explain later.
She pulled out her computer and tapped at the screen.
Sending you our coordinates now.
She cut the line. The water level had risen a good inch just while she was on the call. It pushed excrement from the hallways and floated the soiled clothing and sheets on the floor.
Megot stared at the rising water with an unreadable expression.
I was ready to fight back, you know, he said. I had my gun in hand when the birds boarded the ship. Was going to unload on them, kill as many of the vermin as I could, then pull the pin on a grenade and blow myself to hell. I wasn't a coward. I wasn't going to surrender or hide.
Whatever else you aren't a coward. I'll agree with that much. That was obvious from your stupid revolt on Sentinel 3.
It was stupid. He managed a weak chuckle. I wish I could take that back, believe me. Life under that spineless fool Lee is still life. And fighting the birds, not working for them.
So what happened?
Dijkstra hit me from behind. He'd come with me into the bay as the Lance overtook us. Said he was going to fight to the death by my side, but he bashed me on the skull with the butt of his gun as soon as I turned my back. I woke up strapped to a bench, and one of the birds standing over me.
Megart shuddered. Bright green and red plumage. One of the Queen Commanders. Thought she was going to eat me alive.
If only I had been so lucky. Two of the grey birds pried open my mouth with their claws. The Queen Commander lowered her beak to my mouth. I thought she was going to tear out my tongue. I'm not so brave that I didn't scream. Instead, she dripped her saliva into me. It tasted sweet, did you know that? Like condensed milk, you know. I tried to spit it out, but some of it went down my throat.
Tolvern was horrified, yet fascinated at the same time.
Then I got sick, vomiting. Soon, I could hear, literally hear, a bird cawing in my head. You know that jeering sound a crow makes, like that. Only I could understand somehow. Not the words, but my body knew what to do. Set these coordinates in the nav computer. Put this amount of thrust. That sort of thing.
It controls your mind?
You ever hear of those wasps that lay eggs in caterpillars? First the larvae eat the caterpillars from the inside. Then the victim protects the larvae from predators, even as they chew their way out. That's what I would have done too. Killed to protect the creature that did this to me.
Tolvern tightened her grip on the rifle through all of this, and though Megot looked feeble and dying, she was going to take no chances. Now she slid her finger over to the trigger, convinced he was about to spring at her.
Would have? She asked. Or still would?
Megot managed a wan smile.
It's gone, Tolvern. They've left my head. Now that I'm dying, there's no point. Happened to Dijkstra 2 days ago. He got his mind back. Too late for him, of course. I locked him up in his quarters, under orders from the birds. A few hours ago, when I came down from orbit, I finally got sick enough that they left me alone, too. I came down to let Dijkstra out. Well, to kill him before killing myself. Turns out he was already dead.
Why did Apex send you here? Was it to pave the way for the buzzards to invade?
I don't know. I think they want spies in human space. Turns out their mind control isn't good. They can parasitize us all right, but not without killing the host. Not yet.
A thin smile.
I expect they're working on that.
Captain? Cap called from the hallway. We gotta get out of here?
The water was halfway up Tolvern's boots and caking them with the filth. She didn't think she was in danger. Boykin took spit directly in the face. The buzzards pried open Megot's mouth so the queen could drip saliva down his throat. Tolvern wasn't going to catch an infection because of a little dirty water. The bigger worry was that the ship would sink into the mud, or that the flood water would rise so quickly they wouldn't be able to escape. But if they did run outside, what then? Carvalho's truck was surely submerged by now. They'd have to climb on top of Morpho and wait for Rodriguez to rescue them before the ship went under.
Come on, let's get you out of here, she said. I've got the gist of it. You can tell me the rest later.
I'm not going.
Sure you are. There might be a cure, you never know.
You don't need to lie.
He started coughing again, but this time got it under control. The birds have changed the chemistry of my brain, burned new channels to control me. No medical science can fix that.
You're no doctor, and neither am I. I'll put you in stasis and let someone take a look at you.
At the very least, you might help us figure out what they're doing, so we can protect others in the future.
This got through to him, or seemed to, and he looked contemplative for a moment. Then his expression hardened, and he saw the arrogance, the unyielding nature of the man who'd tried to take over the battle station so as to maintain his faith in staying eternally hidden, even against all evidence to the contrary. He reached around and pulled out something that had been hidden behind his back. It was a grenade. Tolvern stiffened, but he held up his other hand, as if to show he meant no harm.
"No," he said. "I won't hurt you."
She relaxed a little, but kept an eye on the door, ready to dive for the corridor.
"You don't have to kill yourself."
"Why will you do it for me?"
"Mega, listen to me. You can help us. Isn't that worth staying alive a little longer?"
"What does it matter?" he asked bitterly. "My home world is dead, and a harvester ship is picking over the corpse. Yes, I know what's going on. We had no trouble picking up news from the refugee colonies on Samburundown, and Apex didn't care if we found out or not. If Singapore is gone, what reason is there for living?"
"There are the other human colonies, and the Hroom, sentient people civilized. Hundreds of inhabited worlds that will fall to Apex."
"Let them burn. Let the whole galaxy burn to a cinder. It's nothing to me. Now go, before I change my mind and kill us both."
"I won't let you do it."
Tolvern lifted her rifle and pointed it at his chest. He had the grenade, yes, but his hand wasn't on the pin.
"Put it down, or I'll kill you, and we'll study your brain anyway."
"You all right in there, Captain?"
"Perfectly fine, Lieutenant. I've got this under control."
Cap's voice got louder.
"I heard raised voices, I..." "Oh, bloody hell, a grenade."
"Go back into the hall, Cap."
"Aye, Captain."
Sweat was pouring down Magat's temples. He suppressed a cough. As soon as he broke into another fit, she'd rush in and grab the grenade. The water came midway up her calf now. Time to get out. But first, something occurred to her.
"How did you say they communicated with you? They gave you orders directly to your brain?"
"Yes, squawking in my brain. I didn't understand the words, but my body did. It responded, and I could figure out later what had happened."
"One command per behavior, or like a conversation with your body?"
"Like a conversation. Move here, now do this. It doesn't matter. Let me die with dignity, Tolvern."
"You are still protecting their secret, you know. You are going to blow yourself to pieces, so my scientists can't study what the buzzard spit did to your head."
"You won't learn anything from my brain."
"I already did," she said.
The wheels were turning rapidly now.
"Light travels at 186,000 miles per second. That is the speed of any non-subspace communication, and I don't think you have a subspace communicator installed in your brain. How many times have I had a conversation with someone where I wait and wait for a response as the signal crosses a million miles of space? But a Queen Commander spits in your mouth, and a few days later can jerk you around like a puppet on strings, from a distance?"
Magat only stared at first, but then horror dawned on his face.
"Right, so now you understand," she said. "That means the buzzards are here already, aren't they? Maybe not right here on this ship, but close enough, and I'll bet they're still talking to you."
"No."
"In that case, prove it. Drop the grenade in the water."
He moved. Not his hands, not for the grenade. Instead, he reared back, his head, spittle glistening on his lips. He cleared his throat. Tolvern lifted the gun and fired. Magat jerked backward. A wad of slimy green snot oozed out of his mouth. It had been intended for her. Cap burst into the room, gun drawn and shouting. She took in Magat, blood draining from a hole in his chest, then looked at the captain, eyes wide. Tolvern didn't have a chance to respond before her comlink opened, with Smythe on the other end. His voice was high and frightened-sounding.
"Captain, there's a bloody Apex Harvester ship in orbit!"
Chapter 17 Admiral Drake kept his ships cloaked as they approached the Apex fleet. The Lancers were harassing a large refugee fleet, composed of several dozen ships that had been sneaking along through the debris left by numerous battles in the Padong system. Most of the refugee vessels were small freighters or merchant frigates.
One ship looked like a war junk with an undersized engine that had been stripped of weapon systems. Finally came a cluster of huge barges, 500 meters long, of the kind that usually traveled in escorted convoys. Unfortunately, there were no escorts. A handful of ships had deck guns and small lasers, but Apex picked at these threats and took them out one by one. Lances destroyed a small torpedo boat-like vessel, then attacked a merchant frigate with a deck gun. It tried to target enemy ships as they swooped in from all angles toying with it, but failed to score any hits. The lances kept playing with it, harassing it. Soon Apex had driven the frigate away from the rest of the fleet. None of the other ships came to its aid, but continued their full-speed flight. The faster ships began to outpace the slower ones, as all discipline was lost.
"It's like a herd of caribou," Manx said, "sacrificing a sick herdmate to a pack of ravenous wolves while they make a run for it."
"It will do them little good in the end," Drake said. "These particular wolves are never sated."
Something occurred to him.
"And we're doing the same thing, aren't we? Using the death of that ship to shield us. Throck, how long until we're in range?"
Throckmorton called down to the gunnery to find out, and soon came back with an answer.
"We can fire the Crotalus batteries now if you'd like, sir. They're already within range."
"Sir," Manx said, "if the Crotalus batteries can fire, that means our missile frigates are also within range."
Drake considered.
"We're still too far away to inflict damage, but we might scatter them." "Shall I give the order, sir?"
Throckmorton asked.
"No, hold fire and keep cloaked."
He turned to his pilot.
"Continue on course. The longer we stay undetected, the better."
"You're a ruthless one, aren't you?" Ko said. "You let that frigate die to buy a few minutes."
The Singaporean had come back onto the bridge while the merchant ship fought for its life, and now stood 2 paces off from the tech officers, watching the big view screen and gnawing on her thumb.
"Ruthless would be letting our whole civilization die to buy time," Drake said. "This is the simple matter of expedience in a combat situation. I'm going to win this battle, and that's going to save a whole lot more lives than whoever is on that frigate."
His words sounded bolder than he felt as he watched the final struggles of the frigate play out. Its gun stopped firing, either damaged or out of ammunition. A lance made a short jump and drifted in behind almost casually as it let off short pulses of energy at the frigate's engine. It was a calculated attack designed to cripple, not destroy. The frigate made one attempt to evade, and then plasma gushed out like blood from a wound. A lance came in and harpooned it. Curses sounded across Dreadnought's bridge. Ko said something in Chinese, her voice a wail of pain. One of the young ensigns at the defense grid computer muttered a prayer in Old Earth English. 3 small pods blasted out the side of the frigate as the lance came in, launching in random directions. Another lance went after these and snared them one by one. Stay on board or flee. There was no escape for the crew and passengers of the doomed frigate. How many refugees had packed inside? It was easy to imagine their terror as the birds came screaming in to take their prisoners. Men, women, children, the young and the old, even infants. The buzzards would show no mercy. The rest of the enemy ships continued after the refugee fleet. No other human ships fired. Maybe they couldn't. Apex lances had destroyed or disabled several by now. Or maybe they were terrified of revealing themselves and making themselves the new target. Either way, the lances attacked unopposed. About 30 minutes later, Drake checked the range with tech officers and the specialists at the defense grid computer, then nodded at Manx.
"Call the barracks. I want 100 Marines brought out of stasis. Get them armed and in defensive positions."
"Yes, sir."
As Manx got on the comm, Drake called down to the gunnery.
"Dreyfus, this is the Admiral."
"Yes, my lord."
"Sir, is good enough. I want all hands in 10 minutes. Do you remember what I said about the torpedoes?"
"Yes, sir. Fire the Mark IVs at close range only."
"Therefore repelling boarding attempts. I'm bringing Marines out of stasis, but I don't want to take chances if those buzzards harpoon us."
"The Mark IVs are old, sir, but they still pack a hell of a punch, and the worst damage is the kind you inflict on yourself. We shoot at that range. It's going to feel like shooting off leeches with a pistol, sir."
"Understood," Drake said. "But we can take a few blows, even the self-inflicted kind. You will keep those boarders away, am I understood?"
"Yes, sir."
On the one hand, Drake itched to test his marines against Apex in armed combat. He might learn some valuable things about how the enemy fought. But this was a naval battle. Dreadnought's gun would be the deciding factor, not her marines. Lloyd spoke up from the tech console.
The defense grid says 15 minutes until we can fire the medium-range ordnance. All of our missile frigates are in range already. The torpedo boats can make a charge at any moment.
The fleet had gone silent since spotting the enemy fleet 12 hours earlier, but Drake needed to speak to his two most important captains before commencing battle.
Manx, get me Woodbury and Cates.
The two captains appeared side by side on the viewscreen moments later. Adam Woodbury was about 35, with a thin mustache and a curly black fringe around his prematurely balding head. Between the hair and the narrowed eyes, he had a vaguely monkish appearance. Woodbury's ship was HMS Repulse, an aggressor-class cruiser, and, after Dreadnought and Blackbeard, one of the most powerful ships in the Navy. He gave a curt nod.
Admiral?
Appearing next to him on the split screen was Rutherford's old protege, the young Catherine Cates. A year ago, a commander of a small torpedo boat, but now one of Drake's most important officers. Her ship was the older HMS Richmond, rebuilt in the yards with newer armaments and armor, but still not a match for Repulse. But what the ship lacked in combat effectiveness, it made up for in the aggression and intelligence of her commanding officer. Cates was fearless, her crew loyal and tireless.
Yes, Admiral?
She looked like she was positively vibrating with energy as she stared at him, waiting for him to respond.
I've prepared the first few moves of combat, which I'm sending over now, and transmitting to the other ships of the fleet. After that, you are on your own. I cannot risk the buzzards anticipating moves as I transmit first to you, and then have you pass them along to your subordinates. That means we'll shortly be operating as three independent forces. Cates will take command of the destroyer screen and the missile frigates, Drake continued, and Woodbury will lead the other cruisers and the corvettes. I will personally hold the torpedo boats in reserve under my command. While Cates screens Dreadnought, Woodbury will charge at the refugee fleet on my signal. Don't worry about the Singaporeans. What they do is of no consequence. But I want those lancers in disarray.
Yes, sir, Woodbury said,
looking pleased to be hurled so soon into battle. Cates, on the other hand, let a shadow pass over her face that Drake noticed at once. He dismissed Woodbury, but kept the younger captain on the screen.
Is that a problem, Cates? Speak frankly.
I'm to act as a screen, sir, and Dreadnought is to be held in reserve?
Woodbury is going to scatter the enemy, and we're going to pick them off from a distance. But don't worry, you'll see some fierce combat. There's another Apex fleet around here somewhere, and they're going to materialize shortly.
How do you know that, sir?
Life is cheap for the buzzards, we've known that for a long time. And not just the lives of drones, but commanders, too. But more than that, there's something ritualized in their fighting. Have you ever heard of the Flower Wars?
Cates shook her head.
Something from Old Earth?
The Aztecs. The Flower Wars were about capturing prisoners for religious purposes, not seizing enemy territory. The bloodiest Aztec rituals required thousands upon thousands of victims. Prisoners were drugged and marched to the tops of the pyramids, where priests would cut out their still-living hearts. There were so many sacrificial victims that it was said that a cascade of blood would flow all the way to the base of the pyramid.
I beg your pardon, sir, but what does that have to do with this battle?
General Mos Driz sent me data on a number of battles with Apex, some dating back several years. I've been studying them these past several days. Illuminating.
Sir?
Two things seem to matter to the buzzards. First, capturing the highest number of victims. The most aggressive action comes against planetary targets, where they can harvest victims by the millions. Second, the higher the status of the enemy, the more effort is expended in capturing it. Low-status targets may be exterminated, but captains, commanders, governors, kings, never.
It was upon studying the general's records that Drake understood Apex's casual dismembering of the Froome Empire. The Froome had been overwhelmed, and resistance was scattered. Civil war, defeat at the hands of Albion, and crippling sugar addictions had already devastated their race. The Froome were useful for securing large numbers of victims, but Apex didn't find them as valuable as humans. And the Albionish, unbeaten and unbowed,
were of higher value than Singaporeans.
At first glance, Apex tactics are complex and difficult to understand, Drake continued. But when they're trying to lure high-value targets, patterns emerge. One pattern is the extended tormenting of low-value targets, when it would seem easier to annihilate them.
Exactly what they're doing here, Kate said. So this is a trap?
I believe so. They're trying to attract a high-value target. And what is Apex's most valuable enemy in the Dragon Quadrant?
HMS Dreadnought. So they're trying to catch us, she added after a moment of thought. You specifically. They know we're in the area, but our cloaking is too good for their long-range sensors. As long as we stay quiet, they can't find us.
The time has come to end that, Drake said. I'm going to send a subspace to Blackbeard, to Peerless, to the General. We'll bring active sensors online. That will tell the buzzards where we are. In case it's not clear enough, we're dropping our cloaks and letting them see what we are and show we want to fight.
If you're right and there's another enemy fleet in the system, she said, they're going to come right at Dreadnought.
At which point you will no longer be held in reserve, Captain Cates.
Woodbury's cruiser force pulled away from Dreadnought a few minutes later. Cloaks came down across the fleet. Tech Officer Lloyd sent subspace messages to Blackbeard, Peerless, and the Hroom General to tell them that a fight was brewing in the Padong system. Throckmorton and Lloyd hammered away with active sensors, and soon enough they found the hidden fleet. It was cloaked a few million miles away, behind a large wandering asteroid, several million miles distant from the system's belt. The asteroid was more than 150 miles across and shaped like a giant boot, as if the middle part of it had been broken away by an ancient collision. The Apex fleet snugged in tight, jostling each other as they stayed on the far side. Albion sensors still sniffed them out. Of course, active sensors also gave away the location of the Royal Navy fleet. Almost instantly, the enemy ships broke away from the asteroid and moved in toward the action. They ignored Woodbury's ships charging to relieve the refugee fleet and swung toward the Admiral's flagship. It was a powerful force, 7 more hunter-killer packs, comprising 28 lances and 2 spears. Against them, the battleship HMS Dreadnought, Kate's cruiser, 4 destroyers, 3 missile frigates, and 9 torpedo boats. Apart from a few skirmishes, Drake had only seen HMS Dreadnought in action as an enemy, when he'd led a fleet of rebel cruisers against Lord Malthorn. The battleship had seemed almost indestructible from that vantage. Even when Vigilant rammed the ship and destroyed itself, the sacrifice had only managed to disable Dreadnought, not destroy it. But the battleship had never faced lances. The small maneuverable ships would never stand up to Dreadnought's batteries, but they didn't have to. They could jump in close, unleash their energy weapons, and dance away. But Drake noticed a weakness in the enemy fleet as it approached. They don't have a capital ship, Drake told his first mate. Manx had been working quietly for the past 20 minutes, so engrossed in his work with the gunnery and the Royal Marines set up to repel boarders that he didn't seem to be following the action developing on the screen.
No harvester ship, Manx responded after studying it for a moment. At least none that we can see, anyway.
On the one hand, Drake was disappointed. He'd been itching to slug it out with one of the powerful enemy vessels since spotting them in the Kettle system. And if Dreadnought were truly a prize for the Apex commanders, why hadn't they brought their largest ships to assure victory? The behavior didn't make sense. Aliens behave like aliens. Humans, on the other hand, were entirely predictable. There was a nervous tension on the bridge, almost a buzzing, like excitement and fear shaken into a cocktail and swallowed too fast. There was a new element to the nerves, the knowledge that a loss meant more than simple death. Cates sent a message urging him to charge at the enemy. He told her to hold. They'd already formed a defensive position and were perfectly placed to either rush to support Woodbury or call him back to fight off the newcomers. The larger force of lances and spears was still closing 30 minutes away when Woodbury's forces closed ranks with the smaller number of enemies feasting among the refugee fleet. 5 corvettes and 3 cruisers came screaming into the action behind a barrage of missiles. The lances scattered, unharmed, but a missile struck a large refugee schooner, unlucky enough to be in the way. Gases jetted from its hull, and the schooner twisted away,
damaged and trying to regain control as it blazed away from the rest of the refugee fleet. A lance raced by on its way to gather with other Apex craft organizing nearby, and let out two pulses of orange fire as it passed the schooner. It was casual, almost like a man swatting mosquitoes while he aims his gun at a larger prey. The fire engulfed the small Singaporean ship, and it vented burning gases that left a ghostly streak across Dreadnought's viewscreen as it died. Woodbury divided his force in two, with his own repulse and three corvettes chasing after the lance, before it could gain the safety of its companions. Repulse now faced the flaming wreckage of the schooner hurtling in from one side. He had no choice but to target it with his cannon or he'd be hit. The Singaporean vessel burst into pieces. Woodbury's prey jumped to safety before Repulse could target it from closer range. But now the cruiser and its escorting corvettes burst into the pack of lances trying to reform themselves. The Navy warships launched torpedoes and veered away. Two torpedoes slammed into a lance that was too slow to evade, and a chasing missile obliterated the wreckage moments later. The other lances came after the rear corvette, and a spear and two more lances sliced up from below. But Repulse dumped a flood of bomblets behind them, driving off pursuers. Meanwhile, the other Navy force, led by two cruisers but only one corvette, targeted a spear that had been systematically demolishing one of the larger refugee barges. The spear had continued firing during the initial charge, but now its protective lances were gone, chased off. It rolled away from the barge, which was little more than a corpse squirting gas and debris, and turned its energy weapons at the lead corvette. The corvette returned fire with its laser and launched torpedoes. The two cruisers flashed by on either side of the spear, firing their main batteries as they passed. Zeeland's cannons landed a powerful series of punches. Shots cracked along the side of the enemy ship. But it was Formidable that delivered the killing blow. Her cannons ripped a gash in the spear's stern, and a parting torpedo detonated against the damaged armor plating. There was nothing but debris when Formidable was done with it. Several lances chased the fleeing human ships. Unfortunately, the corvette HMS Flash couldn't keep up. The enemy spear had damaged Flash's engines before its death, and the corvette was now leaking plasma. By the time the other two captains realized and slowed the cruisers to come to Flash's aid, the corvette had come under heavy fire. Other lances kept jumping in, closing to battle with that impossible speed that gave the enemy such an advantage. HMS Flash died in a manner befitting its name, going in a burst of light and several secondary explosions. The pair of cruisers beat a hasty retreat, pursued by several enemies. Woodbury swept around with his ships to give assistance before they could be overwhelmed. This was where Drake would have come lumbering in to finish the fight. Some of the enemies had continued forward together with the refugee fleet, but a large force had targeted Woodbury. Dreadnought and her support vessels had more than enough firepower to end it. But instead, Drake was facing a massive, hard-charging attack from the second larger fleet, even as Woodbury continued to battle several million miles away. Drake waited until the first lance jumped, then ordered Dreadnought to roll over and dive on the Z-axis. Like a sperm whale plummeting into the abyss, change position, outsmart the enemy. The other human ships followed or positioned themselves for attack. One by one, the other lances and spears jumped into the attack, firing as they surfaced. Chapter 18. Tolvern led the others into the driving rain at the edge of Morpho's loading bay. Carvalho had turtled the truck before they entered the ship, which left it enclosed and dug into the mud. Sealed against water, it sent tendrils into the earth to keep from washing away, and would remain submerged until the flooding retreated and it could be excavated. But there was no sign of it now, nor of any other vehicle. The water was now knee-deep in the loading bay and still rising. She stared out into the rain, then activated the comm.
"Where the devil is that truck, Smythe?"
"5 minutes. I swear to God you'll have it by then." Behind Smythe came the sound of shouting and Nib Pim's high voice calling for something. It sounded like chaos on the bridge, and her heart caught in her throat. She wanted to demand an update, but there was no sense in that. All she would do was distract them from whatever urgent business had them occupied. Get back to Blackbeard, then worry. When Smythe was gone, there was nothing left to do but stare into the rain and wait for Rodriguez to send a truck. A strange green light penetrated the cloud cover, illuminating a sky that had been almost black when they discovered Morpho. The air rumbled as if with distant artillery, and crackles of electric energy sparked overhead. A thunderclap split the sky, and they threw themselves down. Tolvern came up, spitting muddy water.
"That ain't no thunder," Cap said.
Tolvern didn't answer. She was staring face to face with a pair of giant bulbous eyes that emerged from the water just beyond the loading bay. Before she could lift her gun or shout a warning, the toad's tongue lashed out and wrapped around her neck. It yanked her from her feet and dragged her toward its mouth, which yawned cave-like in front of her. The toad had a bony ridge instead of teeth, and she'd seen what it was capable of. Strong enough to mash the bones of another toad, it would crush her to pulp. "I'm going to die," a calm part of her mind said, as a smell like fish guts washed over her. Eaten by a giant toad. Gunfire erupted all around her. The tongue held on, pulling her underwater as the toad dove away from the attack. But it spasmed, and then she was free. She kicked her feet and her head broke the surface. And then O'Keefe grabbed one arm, Oglethorpe the other, and Cap her hair. They dragged her back into the loading bay. The water was to her thighs as she rose shakily to her feet.
"Bloody hell,"
Tolvern said, a quaver in her voice. Her legs felt like soggy bits of yarn.
"Stay back from the edge. Hand cannons, those who have them. One of those things shows itself, you give it to him."
The floor shifted beneath them, and three of them fell. Carvalho was one of them, and he shook the water from his gun as he got back up.
"The ship is sinking in the mud. We have to swim for it."
He was right. And though it didn't seem likely that the mud was deep enough to swallow Morpho entirely, the water was rising more rapidly now. O'Keefe was the shortest, and the water was nearly at her chest. She held her rifle over her head and nervously eyed the water beyond the loading bay.
"We won't swim 10 feet before a toad eats every last one of us," Ortiz said.
"We can't stay here," O'Keefe said. "We'll drown."
"Either way, we're dead,"
Ortiz said.
"Blast you all, I should have taken my chances in the city."
Cap glared at him.
"The only thing I bloody well know is that the whiner is always the first to go. That's the bleeding universe telling you to shut your gob."
"Enough of this," Tolvern said. "Oglethorpe, you can swim with that bad shoulder?"
"I'll manage."
"Give me your gun. Quickly now, no arguments. The rest of you, follow me."
But as they headed toward the edge of the ship, prepared to dive into the water, a welcome sight greeted their eyes. A pair of headlights appeared, mixing with the strange green light overhead to create an eerie tableau, where the rain looked like shimmering translucent curtains of emerald. The headlights belonged to Rodriguez's truck. Unlike the semi-amphibious vehicle that Carvalho had brought into the city, this one had fully converted into its aquatic form, a lumbering shape that was half bus, half boat. It bristled with spikes, but at first glance the precaution looked unnecessary. It was far too large for a toad to swallow. But as it pulled closer, Tolvern saw that several of the spikes were bent. Something must have tried. A man sat up top, behind a turreted machine gun protected with a gun shield. The truck swung, motors heaving, and bumped against the side of the partially submerged spacecraft. A door swung open on top of the vehicle, and someone shouted for them to get inside. They scrambled up top, then lowered themselves inside one by one. Tolvern was the last, and hadn't yet closed the hatch before the truck was motoring away. There were several other men and women in the back of the vehicle, as wet and bedraggled as Tolvern and her crew. She sent the others back and squeezed up front, where she was surprised to discover Rodriguez himself driving the truck. He hunched over the wheel, squinting out the window through the driving rain, and grunted a greeting as she settled into the seat next to him.
"Seems to be letting up, don't you think?"
he asked, his tone ironic.
"Expect soon it will be a drizzle."
"Took you long enough."
"Sorry for the delay," he said. "Had a few other stops to make on my way."
"You're here, that's all that matters.
Get me to my ship and we'll call it good. Absolutely, I've got to look after my best client. What, you afraid I'll fly off without you?
Yeah, that is about the shape of it, Tolvern. I don't mean to let you out of my sight. The buzzards are here, and I won't be left behind.
What's that green light? She asked.
Nothing good, not if you assume the Singaporeans know what they're talking about. Green light, bad. They all agree on that much, means the buzzards have landed, and are looking for a snack.
He maneuvered, keeping away from the light. As he drove, he explained that thousands of refugees were fighting their way through toads and floodwater to rush the yards. His men were holding them on the road a mile or two from the perimeter, but they couldn't hold the mob indefinitely. Ships had been blasting off from ports all over the planet, filled with human and Froom alike. An Apex fleet was in orbit, sending landing craft down and killing, disabling, or capturing fleeing vessels. But a fair number were slipping through the cordon and breaking for deep space. Tolvern found some hope among the grim news. If she could get Blackbeard into orbit, she could take advantage of the chaos to fight free of the planet. Strike a couple of blows, take charge of whatever forces were struggling against Apex, maybe even drive the buzzards off. Be honest, there's no hope of that. Get up, get free. Then run, leave Samborondon to its fate. The truck hit a floating tree, but powered over the top of it, and continued on its way. They were making good progress, now only minutes away from the space yards, according to Rodriguez. And the rain seemed to be letting up. What had once seemed an impossible dump of water had become merely a downpour. And then they ran aground. Tolvern hadn't buckled her restraints, and flew forward, slamming into the dash. Rodriguez tried to tear the vehicle loose. But the truck wouldn't reverse, and when he dropped the wheels, that wouldn't get him out of the mud either. He cursed.
I'll have to call another vehicle to winch us out of here, and we're only about 500 meters from high ground, too.
We could swim it.
It'll be faster this way, trust me.
He touched his ear.
I need a track out here. We're wedged in.
He switched to Ladino, a rapid-fire stream of syllables, then back to English.
I don't care. Get someone out here now.
The vehicle shuddered. Shouts from the passengers in back. A dark shape smacked into the windshield, and a huge bulbous eye peered in. Another toad. The gun up top chattered. The toad flailed and bellowed in pain. Rather than retreating, it tried to scramble and hop to the top of the truck to get at its tormentor, but the machine gun unloaded too much firepower even for such a massive beast, and it soon stopped shuddering. Its bulk completely covered the windshield, blocking their view, which brought fresh curses from Rodriguez.
"Dumb beast," he said. "Now we've got to winch you off, too."
The truck shuddered again, this time from the back left side. Another toad, apparently testing them out for a meal. Rodriguez touched his ear.
"Diablos, I don't care what's happening. I need a truck out here now. We're stuck in the mud. Are you listening to me? And I've got the captain and first mate of Blackbeard here. You get that?
I want off this rock," he said when he'd hung up.
The truck was still shaking, but he seemed unconcerned with the attacking toad.
"I'll trade my fee for evacuation, but I'm not going to let those buzzards get their beaks into me. Take my crew, as many as you can hold. We'll be good for your fleet. But we need to get off of Samborondon before it's too late."
Rodriguez's words came out in a rush. Tolvern hadn't intended to renege on her deal, and was scarcely paying attention.
"What's wrong with your gunner?" she asked. "Why isn't he taking care of that toad?"
As if to punctuate her words, the bus rocked again, more violently this time.
"Maybe it will do us a favor and knock us out of the mud."
"With his dead friend lying on top of us? I doubt it."
The port to the gun shield was directly overhead, up a metal ladder. Tolvern scaled the ladder, unsealed the hatch, and pulled herself out into the rain. Rodriguez's gunner was dead. That was what was wrong. The first toad's tongue had found the gap beneath the gun shield, snaked up, and wrapped itself around the man's neck and face. The gap wasn't big enough to pull him through, but the tongue had yanked him through up to the shoulders. His body hung limp, his neck broken, and still encircled by the pale grub-colored tongue that gleamed obscenely beneath the pounding rain. The dead toad itself lay across the front of the truck, shoving it down with its bulk. The machine gun had ripped open its enormous bulging belly, and the contents of its most recent meal oozed out.
Among the remains was a crocodile-like creature, several large scaly fish, a bird that looked like an egret, and a human body. Or half a body. Specifically, the legs and torso. A second toad, nearly as large as the first, was trying to get its mouth around the back end of the truck. It pressed its bulk against the side of one of the spines, using the thick plates on its back to try to snap it off. The truck was twice its size. Did it really think the vehicle was alive, and if it were, that it would possibly be able to swallow it? Moving slowly, she took position at the gun turret and swung it around. The movement caught the eye of the toad, and it opened its mouth, ready to shoot its tongue. Tolvern fired. Gunfire lashed out and caught the toad across its horny snout. It bellowed in pain. Unlike the dead toad draped across the front of the truck, this one didn't fight, but vanished in the water. Cap popped up through the hatch at Tolvern's feet. She looked around, squinting against the rainwater that drained through the gaps in the gun shield, then glanced at the dead gunner as she climbed up.
"I ain't being wrong." Cap nodded down into the truck. "Should have been this idiot instead."
"Hey!"
Ortiz protested, coming up after her. He ducked under the canopy to get into the open air beyond the protection of the gun.
"The whiner should be the first to go," Cap said. "One of the rules of the universe. It ain't fair when some other bloke goes first."
"Where do you think you're going?" Tolvern asked Ortiz.
"I'll let him, Captain. Maybe the toads will do us a favor."
"What do you think?"
Ortiz said.
"I'm trying to get us the hell out of here."
"And how will you manage that?" Tolvern asked. "Lasso a toad and ride it out of here?" The downpour continued to let up, from deluge to torrent, and then to something that felt almost like normal heavy rain. But the water was deep and flowing, and she couldn't spot the space yards, though they must be close. Others climbed the ladder, starting with Carvalho and Oglethorpe. Tolvern didn't think the danger from toads had passed, but they were all armed, and she wanted to get a better look at their surroundings now that she could see a little. So she didn't send them back down. They followed Ortiz out from behind the gun shield. The green light was stronger now, most prominently to their right, across the waterlogged forest and plains. It was moving, shifting.
"The yards are the other direction," Rodriguez said. "Look, you can see the flashes. Can you hear that?"
"Is that you shooting or are you taking fire?"
"Must be the enemy. No way we're shooting up at the buzzards. I've got a few heavy guns, but if I take aim at their ships, they'll bombard us from space. I meant to save them until it was time to bust out of here, then use them to cover our escape. We'd better hurry, though."
"I'll take you," she said, "and 20 of your crew. No, make it 30. Any more than that, well, we are not a refugee ship. I've got to get up there and fight."
"Understood."
Rodriguez's face was grim, and she could already see him calculating, deciding who to take and who to leave. He was a mercenary man. He wouldn't be choosing based on sentimental reasons. Good. That served her purpose, too. Give her the most highly skilled, irreplaceable workers. The nearest of the green lights swung toward them, and the source of the light emerged from the rain. It came from a massive machine that stalked west toward the yards. The thing was as tall as a tree, at least 80 feet in height, and walked on a pair of slender, stilt-like legs. A half-dozen tentacles, some thicker than others, dangled from a rounded belly. They seemed to be pulsing, throbbing with movement. Up top, a turret with a gun, and a light like an eye, glowing green. The light swung right and left, but it wasn't bright enough to be a spotlight. What could it be? One of the tentacles snaked out and slapped at the water. When it recoiled, it was thicker and longer than it had been. Another tentacle slapped the water.
"Hold still," Tolvern said. "Nobody move."
It looked for a moment like the walking machine would keep going until it vanished into the rain, but the turret swung in their direction, and she saw now that there wasn't one, but two green lights. They seemed to be scanning the water. Again, one of the tentacles swung down at the water.
"King's balls,"
Oglethorpe said.
"Will you look at that?"
A splash drew Tolvern's attention before she could see what he was indicating. Ortiz's head bobbed up in the water, and he immediately began swimming away from the truck in long, powerful strokes.
"Get back, you ass!" Cap yelled. "You're going to die!" Oglethorpe grabbed Tolvern and yanked her toward the gun shield. A second walker strode up behind the truck, much closer than the other. It limped, and fire smoked on its chest, evidence that someone had offered resistance. Two lights came out of the turret on its head, probing the water. Staring up at it, Tolvern had the sensation that she was looking at a living creature, not a machine. A wounded, angry creature, feeding, as had the giant toads, on the victims of the rising floodwater. One of its legs lifted, a knee-like articulation bending forward as the foot cleared the water. She got a better look. It was a clawed bird foot. And then everything changed. The turret was really a head. The green lights, eyes, something both mechanical and organic. The gun emerged from a beak. The plates of armor were huge, rigid feathers. The legs were real legs belonging to a giant bird, and the tentacle-like appendages dangling from the belly. The giant bird cocked its head as Ortiz swam away from it. His strokes turned frenzied, panicked. The light fell on him. Instantly, he stiffened and began to sink. One of the tentacles darted for him and came up, holding his limp, dangling figure. The giant bird turned its head, and Ortiz came back to life, thrashing and fighting. The tentacles were a mass of writhing, struggling bodies. The harvest, live sacrifices for the Queen Commander. All of this happened in an instant, and already Tolvern and the others were moving. Bolts clicked, grenades popped into the back of hand cannons. Cap scrambled for the machine gun. The giant bird turned toward them, the lights of its eyes moving in their direction. It smelled of feathers and burning plastic. A viscous, tar-like substance drained from the smoking wound on its chest. The green lights swung toward them as the bird cocked its head. It was only 100 feet away. 2 strides, and it would be upon them. Tolvern flipped her rifle to full auto, lifted it to her shoulder, and let loose. The men and women on the surface of the truck opened up around her. Gunfire lashed at the bird, with 2 flashes of light as the hand cannons fired their shots. The heavy chug-chug-chug from Tolvern's left announced an attack from the machine gun, accompanied by Cap's cursing threats as she fired. The green lights fell upon them, even as the first shots struck it in the chest. Tolvern's limbs went limp as the light hit her, and she fell. A sound like static filled her ears, and electric currents raced to her extremities, until they felt like they were on fire. But she lay motionless, not so much as twitching, as she slid off the truck and plopped into the water. Tolvern's thoughts remained coherent as she slowly sank. She was screaming inside, trying to regain control of her body, trying to fight and struggle to the surface. The water churned, and something thick and rubbery wrapped around her waist and hoisted her up. She regained control of her body the instant she came out of the water. She struggled, trying to free herself, as a tentacle dragged her up, tightening around her waist like a python gripping its prey. Cap was below her on the tentacle, thrashing and screaming, and Carvalho, O'Keefe, and Oglethorpe were on another tentacle, fighting and kicking as the giant bird bent to Rodriguez's truck and tore it open with its beak. It sent in a rubbery appendage, seemingly oblivious to the gunfire that lit up the interior of the truck to drive it off, and emerged with several more victims. Then the bird lifted a leg and began to stalk away from the ruined vehicle. Its tentacles squirmed with victims. Chapter 19. Tolvern kept struggling. How could she have been so stupid? Cap had been taken too, Oglethorpe and Carvalho. Who would fly the ship, Smythe and Nib Pym? Would they be smart enough to take off, or would they wait until it was too late? She shouldn't have been caught out like this. She cursed her stupidity. But that fury gave way to terror for what came next. Apex would know her. They would identify her as the captain of the Albion warship. Her companions would die gruesome deaths, but a special sort of torture awaited her. Not knowing its specifics made her all the more desperate. The coiled tentacle pinned her right arm against her side, but the left was free. She scratched at the tentacle, beat it with her fist, tried to bite, but she couldn't get her mouth around it, and it seemed to be made of rubber. Only a few feet below her, Cap fought her own struggle, accompanied by curses against God, the king, the country, and the universe for good measure. The others from the truck were all around, crying out, trying to fight free. This particular creature had dozens of people in its tentacles, and the majority were fighting to free themselves. It was the writhing that she'd spotted below. The creature was limping worse than ever. The tar-like blood ran down its chest. It had taken gunfire and hand cannons and tossed its head, squawking as if in pain. It fell behind the other birds that stalked their way toward the base. But though it was injured, the monstrous creature was no mere animal. And it wasn't so injured that it didn't keep turning its head from side to side as it paced through the water, looking for more victims as it worked its way forward. The bird crossed an elevated road, now only a few feet above the water. One of the spike-covered trucks from town came racing toward the bird as it straddled the road. Green light fell on the truck, which spun out of control and crashed into a guardrail. The bird climbed onto the road and pinned the vehicle with one claw, like an egret holding a crab, then tore at the truck with its beak. It plucked off spikes and peeled back the roof. A tentacle snaked into the interior and came out with several writhing, screaming people. Tolvern couldn't pry herself loose of the tentacle wrapped around her waist, but she could do something with her left arm besides pound futilely. She reached around the tentacle and, groping, found her sidearm. It was still in its holster, thank God. Hanging nearly upside down, a painful pressure on her waist, she was terrified of fumbling the gun and watching it disappear into the water below. But she got it out without dropping it. Cap had stopped struggling below her and craned her neck to look up.
"You'll never injure it with that pea-shooter, Captain. Shoot yourself. Get it over with. Now wait. Shoot me first, then yourself."
Tolvern ignored her first mate and steadied the gun. The bird kept swinging its head from side to side. The next time it spotted a victim, she'd shoot. Wait until it held its gaze still and get one good shot against one of the green eyeballs. Maybe shoot them both if she were especially lucky. Blind the creature, let it drop them. You're fooling yourself. Of course she had no hope. Bombs from a hand cannon had bounced off its chest, doing little damage. Cap had squeezed off 20 or 30 shots from the 50-caliber machine gun atop the truck before the green light paralyzed them. If that couldn't do anything, there was no way that a single small-caliber bullet, even one fired directly into the eyeball, would do any damage. This was a genetically engineered war machine as much as a living creature. But she had to try. The bird reached the outskirts of the base, where the land rose up the hillside to get the yards above the floodwater. It waded forward, the water growing shallower with every step. Several other birds were already at the perimeter, tearing down the barbed wire with claw and beak. A machine gun opened fire from a guard tower. One of the giant birds opened its beak, and its own gunfire blasted out. It unfolded wings, and a pair of small missiles blasted from either side where the wings met the breastbone. The tower disappeared in a flash of fire and smoke. The bird holding Tolvern cocked its head as it reached the shallows. The green light came down and illuminated something churning up from the mud. It was one of the toads, a massive, warty figure nearly as tall as Rodriguez's truck. The green light fell upon it, but it seemed to have no effect on the creature. The toad spotted the bird's moving legs, opened its mouth, and chomped down on the nearest. The bird squawked and darted down with its beak. It thrust, pecking at the toad, pounding at the warty armor on its back. The toad stubbornly held on and tried to drag the giant bird into the depths, where it could pull it underwater and devour it. Never mind that the bird was 5 times as tall and at least 3 times as massive, and that the toad would never be able to swallow such a meal. The creatures were apparently too simple to understand such concerns. They were pure eating machines. Sit buried during the dry season, then emerge in a deluge and gorge. It would eat anything moving, no matter how large or indigestible. The bird unfolded its wings, and 2 small rocket launchers appeared under each one. Tolvern aimed her pistol at the exposed breast before it could shoot, and fired,
She shot again and again until she'd emptied her pistol. It bellowed in pain, though how much of that was the toad and how much was the gunfire, it was impossible to say. The bird went down with a terrific crunching sound, its leg bending in the wrong direction. Tolvern hit the water. The tentacle remained around her waist, dragging her down. She thrashed to free herself, but it held her tight, and soon her lungs were bursting. Finally, it was gone, slithering away. She bumped into someone as she kicked at the mud. She grabbed the person's hair and dragged them up with her. The toad and the giant bird were locked into a death struggle. The bird slashed with its beak 10 feet long and made of metal. It left gashes and gaping wounds in the thick hide along the toad's back. The toad pulled its eyes into its head and bit and chomped as it tried to subdue the bird. The legs were nothing but broken bones now, and the toad managed to get its mouth around a wing. After that, it was all over. The bird kept thrashing, but no longer did damage to its opponent, which continued its relentless chomping. A few people had surfaced in the water, and Tolvern dragged them away from the fighting to heave them into the muddy shallows. Carvalho was there too, and together they found Cap, Rodriguez, and O'Keefe. Oglethorpe surfaced, as did several others from the truck, plus several people Tolvern didn't recognize, other victims of the harvesting. Ortiz was screaming when they pulled him out. He clenched his abdomen, and when Tolvern pulled his hands away, it looked like a collection of muddy eels, all squirming to get out of his gashed open belly. Behind the pain in his eyes was an accusatory look.
"I never want to, never wanted."
His words dissolved into a groan.
"The bird claw raked him across the belly while it was trying to get free of the toad," Carvalho said grimly.
There was nothing to be done for Ortiz, but there were plenty of survivors. Tolvern and Rodriguez left anyone who was not part of either Blackbeard or the Space Yards to their own devices and collected the rest. Miraculously, Ortiz was the only one who died. Cap appeared holding a pistol. She glanced at Ortiz, grunted, then looked at the giant bird, now dead and being methodically torn apart and eaten.
"Apex, ha," Cap said. "Predator at the top of the food chain. Got yourself eaten by a bloody toad now, didn't you?"
Another toad surfaced and chomped down on the other side of the dead bird. A third came swimming through the floodwater, legs propelling it forward in a frog kick.
"We are alive and we still have fight in us," Tolvern said. "Next step is to make sure we stay that way."
She glanced up at the yards where the giant birds had disappeared, and explosions and gunfire grew in fury.
"Come on, we'll have to follow them in."
Drake stared at the viewscreen as Dreadnought dove on the Z-axis, spinning to prevent the enemy from targeting them in one spot. Enemy lances rolled across the screen. They let loose with energy weapons the moment they appeared. And the computer, Simon the crew called him, warned of damage to the number 3 and 6 shields. Simon's smooth baritone sounded smug, and reminded Drake of nothing more than Admiral Melthorn's butler. The present Admiral missed Jane and Blackbeard at moments like this. But Dreadnought was able to absorb blow after blow in a way that no other ship could. Drake kept them on their current course, even as 10 lances and a spear fell into pursuit, with more ships joining. A second force gathered to send a fresh wave, even as the first wave kept up a relentless attack. The number 5 shield flashed yellow on Drake's console. The other officers on the bridge made worried noises.
"Acquire targets and fire all port side weapons," he said.
Throckmorton passed the order to the gunnery. Moments later, cannons blasted from port. Half a dozen torpedoes launched. The light dimmed as the energy weapons fired and then recharged. Explosive shot destroyed one of the lances, and a torpedo struck a glancing blow to another. The other ships on that side scattered, chased from the battlefield by torpedoes and kinetic fire. Captain Cates had left one of her missile frigates off to one side, where it was vulnerable to attack. The frigates were lightly armored and ill-suited to close-in combat, but perfectly positioned to target the fleeing ships. The enemy's short-range jump engines had not yet recharged, and they now flew into a hailstorm of missiles launched by the frigate. 2 Apex ships took hits and limped away from the battlefield.
A third caught a crippling blow that sent it careening back toward Dreadnought. Dreyfus boys in the gunnery were on the alert as it returned. A torpedo rumbled out from a portside battery and struck the injured lance head-on. The resulting explosion flared, as bright as the sun, then was gone, and with it the enemy ship. Meanwhile, the enemy ships off starboard kept stabbing at Dreadnought shields, and the 7 and 8 shields flashed yellow. There were so many enemies on that side that it looked like a kicked-over hornet's nest. Dreadnought was about to be stung to death, 14 lances in all, plus a spear.
"Fire starboard side?"
Manx asked anxiously.
"Deck gun only, short-range shot. Hold the starboard cannons."
"Aye, sir."
Manx passed the information along to the gunnery, then addressed the crew at the defense grid computer.
"Throck, keep the targeting hot for all inactive starboard batteries."
The reason for Drake's command was soon apparent, as Cates charged in from the rear. She swung her 4 destroyers wide to form a screen to pin the lances against Dreadnought. The 2 remaining missile frigates lobbed missiles over the top of the battle, discouraging a jump to freedom. Then Cates took her own ship, the cruiser Richmond, collected the 9 torpedo boats Drake held in reserve, and thundered into the enemy formation. The torpedo boats closed rapidly and a little too eagerly. 1 torpedo boat took fire along the stern. It vented gases from the upper deck and was soon continuing dead on sheer momentum. Another torpedo boat slashed at a lance, but found itself alone and isolated. A pulse to the torpedo boat's engine disabled it, and a spear and 2 lances fell ravenously upon the wounded prey and tore it to shreds. But the other torpedo boats landed crushing blows against a pair of lances, and Richmond fired her cannons and launched torpedoes as she entered the fray. Expertly maneuvering the powerful cruiser, Cates brought Richmond in against the enemy ships destroying the hapless torpedo boat. She drove them apart with energy pulses. They fled, but ran headlong into Drake's destroyer screen. The 4 destroyers pounded with their cannons, destroying 2 enemies. The spear slipped past, chased off by missiles from a Crotalus battery. The missiles were about to overtake it, finishing the skirmish, when it jumped to safety. Drake stifled a curse to see the spear escape, but he had worries closer at hand that soon drew his attention. The surviving enemy ships, a still powerful force of 10 lances, fought clear of Richmond and the torpedo boats. They could have charged and overwhelmed the destroyers had they moved more decisively, but Cates reacted first and sent her remaining torpedo boats to block their escape. The alien ships, finding their way blocked, swung back toward Dreadnought. Drake fired torpedoes to slow them. Enemy pulse weapons lit up his shields again. The 9 shield joined several others in flashing yellow. And now overall damage on that side was sufficient to warrant a lofty-sounding update from Simon.
"Starboard shields at 82%,
Simon said with a sniff, as if to say Admiral Malthorn certainly never would have taken such damage to his pride and joy.
"I live with that."
So much punishment, and they'd lost less than 20%.
"Throck, get me the gunnery. Fire starboard batteries on my mark."
Drake waited until the last possible moment.
"Fire."
Starboard cannons roared into action, torpedoes from tubes both fore and aft. Energy pulses flared, lances took fire, blew apart, spun out of control to be finished off by Kate's force. Of the 10 enemy vessels, 4 fell in the initial blast, or were gobbled up by torpedo boats. 6 more lances raced past Dreadnought, which fired ordnance from her belly, and then from her rear guns. 3 more enemies met their end. A large piece of wreckage slammed into Dreadnought, but the battleship shrugged it off and continued firing. The last 3 enemy ships jumped away to safety. They appeared moments later, together with the escaping spear, next to the remaining lances, which had surrounded the isolated missile frigate. The frigate had continued throwing missiles into the fight and knocked out 1 of them, but that was to be her final victory. With energy weapons blazing, the Apex ships tore holes in the frigate before it could be relieved. A shot penetrated the magazine, and the remaining missiles went off. When the resulting flash of light dimmed, there was nothing left of the Navy warship but scattered debris. Drake and Cates regrouped,
wary that the enemy fleet would jump back into combat. But as they charged toward the remnants of the Apex forces, the enemy fled. Drake gave chase, but couldn't catch them before they jumped away yet again. Mank slammed his hand into his fist.
By God, we settled their hash, all right.
A triumphant message came through from Cates moments later along similar lines. 28 lances and 2 spears had entered combat. In a few short hours, Drake had destroyed 12 lances and wounded 5 others, effectively destroying half of the enemy fleet's firepower. Against that, he lost 2 torpedo boats and a missile frigate. It was a terrific victory. Unfortunately, he'd left Captain Woodbury's forces dangling out among the refugee fleet, and that battle had continued apace. Apex had regrouped after the initial skirmish, and soon enough the enemy pressed the attack. Woodbury was no fool, and he was more defensive by nature than Cates. Instead of grappling directly, he dodged in and out among the refugee ships and the wreckage. More than once, during Dreadnought's own fight, Ko had looked up from the tech computer to curse Woodbury's cowardice. The Singaporeans were taking the bulk of the casualties. They were helpless non-combatants. And when Drake could spare a moment between engagements, he'd watched the mounting destruction with dismay. But the end result was that Woodbury had survived, and his ship Repulse was still in excellent condition. Another cruiser, HMS Formidable, had taken serious damage to the engines and lay crippled, which forced the remaining Royal Navy vessels in the task force, 4 corvettes and 2 cruisers, to circle in for protection, while the lances stalked them, darting in and out, but avoided an all-out fight. The enemy, too, had taken few additional casualties and was strong enough to keep Woodbury's forces pinned while they waited for reinforcements. And those reinforcements were coming. The remainder of the fleet that had attacked Drake reappeared from their jump, having closed most of the distance.
"Sure would be useful to be able to leap around like that,"
Mank said.
"We'll see if they can do it again," Drake said.
He addressed Ellison at the tech console.
"How long until they reach Woodbury?"
97 minutes," she said. "Assuming a straight-line approach, no jumps."
"And Dreadnought?"
This brought a moment of calculation.
"Almost 3 hours, sir, assuming we leave now."
Drake told the pilot to chart a course. He sent a message to Woodbury, then got the other captains online. No sense hiding his intentions from Apex. It was obvious enough that he had to either order Woodbury to abandon Formidable, long-range scans showed the plasma engines inoperable, but the ship still battle-worthy, or rush to join the fight and hope Woodbury held until he arrived. Drake didn't have so many cruisers lying around that he could afford to throw one away. That wasn't the Royal Navy way in any event, and the devil take him before he left nearly 100 crew to be harvested by the buzzards. Once Dreadnought was underway, Drake turned to his pilot and subpilot and ordered them to chart courses to the various jump points in the systems, starting from an unassumed position several hours in the future.
"That will take some time, sir," the pilot said, "and eat up network resources if we keep the nav computer running that long."
"We can spare them. I need a way out of here."
Ko looked up from her console.
"What about the refugees? Don't tell me you're going to abandon them here."
"Best thing we can do is get them away from the fighting," Drake said. "I'm fully expecting the buzzards to give chase."
"What if they don't?" she asked. "What if they go back to killing these poor people?"
"Then we'll take our revenge later."
"Admiral Drake, there are thousands of refugees in that fleet. You can't leave them to die. You simply can't."
"That's not what you told me before."
"That was different. You can't leave them now, not after you've committed yourself. Please, I..."
Drake fixed Ko with a stare, and she fell silent. This was hard business, and he was not indifferent to the refugees' plight. But events were getting out of hand, and he had to live to fight another day.
"Millions of your people are still alive on Singapore," he said. "If I don't maintain the fighting power of this fleet, they'll all die, every last one of them."
That was the end of Ko's arguments, and they continued toward the battle brewing around the crippled Navy cruiser. The refugee fleet had limped away from the action, still struggling in a long line of ships toward a jump point that remained nearly 6 days' flight at their current speed. Woodbury's ships spat mines, laying a protective field around them. The enemy would no doubt be cataloging them all, and even in tight battle, space was so vast that they'd be able to maneuver through. It might buy 10 or 15 minutes, no more, and would hamper a retreat should Woodbury be forced to abandon the crippled HMS Formidable. The second Apex force was less than 30 minutes away from attacking the injured cruiser. Woodbury would be facing a massive two-pronged attack without reinforcements for the hour and a half it would take Admiral Drake's forces to get there. It didn't sound like a long time, but with Woodbury unable to maneuver if he wanted to protect Formidable, an hour and a half would likely prove fatal. Suddenly, Lloyd called over from the tech console.
"Sir, Formidable is firing up one of her engines."
So she was. It seemed at first that she was going to maneuver into position to be used as a floating battery, but then the second plasma engine flared to life. Formidable swung in a wide arc, with Captain Woodbury positioning the other two cruisers behind her, and his four remaining corvettes in the vanguard. They thrust forward, pressing toward Dreadnought.
"Formidable is accelerating at pace," Lloyd said.
A cheer went up on the bridge of Dreadnought at this news. Formidable's engineers and bosuns deserved medals by God. Getting the damaged engines repaired so quickly, and under such conditions, hopefully those medals wouldn't be awarded posthumously. They'd have to bully their way through the still powerful remnant of the alien fleet Drake had thrashed and sent on its way. But Apex had a curious reaction to this. Instead of moving to plug the gap, the newly arriving force swung wide, while the ones that had kept Woodbury's ships pinned down now moved to block his retreat. That left an open path for Woodbury and Drake's forces to meet in the middle. Manx cleared his throat.
"I hate to point out the obvious, Admiral, but it's an obvious setup." "Right, sir. It looks like a lobster trap. One path in, no way out. They get us all together, and then we're all bottled up."
"I like our odds," Drake said.
"Unless you think there's a third alien fleet hiding somewhere."
"Could be, sir."
That certainly cast the recent engagement in a new light. If there's another enemy force lurking in the area, it stood by, while we destroyed half an Apex fleet.
"They're monsters," Manx said. "Life has no value to them."
Perhaps. Drake could use a consult in the war room, but there was no time. He was still hurtling forward, and Woodbury was accelerating rapidly to meet him. The distance between them would soon be shrinking at a rate nearly 20% the speed of light. Drake told the tech officers to continue searching for a third hidden alien force, but then an unexpected bit of information came through. His pilots had been charting escape routes and now pushed forward an intriguing possibility. Both Drake and Woodbury could change course and bolt for the nearest jump point. They'd have an advantage on their pursuers and could escape the system without engaging in battle.
"What's on the other side of that jump?" he asked. "The charts are unclear, sir," the pilot said. "Co, a word?" Drake said.
She'd been assisting Lloyd in his scans, but now came over to the Admiral's chair. He pointed to the jump point showing on his small screen.
"Where does this lead?"
Co frowned.
"I've just spent 11 years on a hidden battle station. I don't exactly have the systems of the Dragon Quadrant memorized."
"But this is a well-trafficked space lane. You really have no idea."
"It doesn't lead to Singapore, that's for sure."
"Looks like it's semi-stable," Lloyd called over. "But it might only be a few years old. It wouldn't appear on the old charts."
"With an emphasis on semi or stable?" Drake asked.
"We're not going to find ourselves trapped on the other side, if that's what you're worried about," Lloyd said.
That was exactly Drake's worry, that Apex was luring his fleet into jumping into a cul-de-sac system, one way in and out, and that jump point rapidly decaying behind him. He'd go down in Albion history as the admiral who disappeared with his fleet into an unknown system, never to reappear. No, because if he did that, there wouldn't be any Albion history to record his folly. Apex would exterminate his people.
"Lloyd, give me a confidence level. How much longer does that jump point have?"
The answer came a few moments later.
99% certainty of 5.5 years in duration, plus or minus a year. Less than 0.001% that it will decay in less than 6 months.
That was good enough. "Send a message to Woodbury, to Cates, to the other captains. We are making a run for it, standard fleet jump formation."
Drake wanted a fight, but not on Apex's terms. And it seemed that this was the battlefield of the enemy's choosing. He could stand his ground against these two forces, but if a third fleet showed up, he was in trouble.
Better to accept his victory and circle back around to Sentinel 3 and get the tech Lee had promised.
Ellison, he said, time to rendezvous with our friends. Send a subspace to Captain McGann, Captain Tulvan, and General Mosdriz. Here is the message.
The enemy would intercept the subspace, of course, but he did his best to disguise the information. As soon as Drake sent the message, he ordered a course change. Soon, he had his fleet accelerating toward the unknown jump point. Chapter 20 Tulvern and the others made their way through the gap in the perimeter fence and onto the higher ground of the spaceyards. It had turned into a battlefield. Giant birds stalked across the tarmac like walking tanks, even as gunfire and hand cannons blasted at them. They opened their beaks and spewed projectiles, spread their wings to launch missiles. Vehicles burned, and one of the large hangars was on fire, casting flames high into the sky. Green light swept across the ground from the bird's eyes. When it fell on gunmen and fleeing yard workers, the humans and Hroom collapsed to the ground as if they were automatons and someone had flicked a switch. Tentacles swept down and dragged them skyward to join the squirming masses. Tulvern kept clear of the fighting and led the others into a crouching run from the protective wall of warehouses to the shelter of a merchant frigate which sat burning in the middle of the tarmac. The side of the frigate had been torn open, exposing the guts of the vessel, from which smoke and flame poured out.
"I spent £300 repairing that piece of junk," Rodriguez said mournfully, as they waited for one of the giant birds to stride away.
"Never see that money again. Not to mention the black what lost his ship," Cap said.
"Quiet, the both of you," Tulvern said. "Wait until it turns its head. Then we're making a run for it."
It was still raining, but at normal downpour levels. Nothing like the deluge that had overwhelmed Samborondone earlier in the day. The sky was, however, still dark and growing darker. Even as the cloud cover thinned, the sun was dipping behind the western mountains. Soon it would be night. Fortunately, there was plenty of light from the fires to find their way. Tulvern could clearly see the path they needed to take, off toward a pair of undamaged hangars to the left. Blackbeard was inside one of them, hopefully. The bird cocked its head and turned toward something to its right. That left the path open to the left. Tulvern chopped her hand forward and set off at a run. The others followed. She rounded the corner and saw the open doors of the larger of the two hangars, with Blackbeard sitting dark and still inside, and undamaged, thank God. We're going to make it. They'd come into the base with nearly 20 men and women. Tulvern, Cap, O'Keefe, Carvalho, Oglethorpe, and Rodriguez, plus roughly a dozen survivors from the truck. A few others had joined them as they entered the base, and now, running across the open, other yard workers spotted them and broke from hiding places. Soon there were dozens running to join them. One of the giant stalkers noticed all of the movement, and its head swiveled, like a rooster spotting a row of tasty insects. Its gaze swept over the runners and they collapsed. The bird stepped over them, head still swiveling to catch new victims in the green light, even as tentacles dipped from its abdomen to hoist up the ones who had fallen.
"Run!"
Tulvern yelled. So close now. Someone screamed behind her, a sound that was cut dead. Her heart thumped, her lungs burned, her feet pounded the tarmac. Ahead, Blackbeard's familiar curves. It loomed above her, propped on struts. The skull and crossbones gleamed with reflected firelight, the Albion Lions. Green light. Her body went rigid, and she was falling.
No!
She hit hard, tossed casually against the pavement. Her heart thundered in her chest from her exertions, but nothing else was moving, not even her lungs. Behind, the sound of claws on pavement. The screams, as tentacles hoisted men and women into the sky, and they regained control of their bodies, only to find themselves enveloped in the twisting python-like coils. The ground thumped, as if from a giant hammer pounding against the ground. A horrible screech of pain sounded behind her, then a crash. Tulvern could breathe again. She took a ragged gasp. The acrid scent of burning feathers scratched her throat. She tried to rise to her feet, but someone was screaming for her to stay put.
A hand grabbed the back of her pants and yanked her down. It was Carvalho. Lifting her head, Tolvern saw why. Blackbeard's deck gun had opened up and was thumping away with heavy fire. That gun was powerful enough to tear a hole in a pirate schooner, and it was certainly enough to rip apart one of the giant birds, armored or not. It had mowed down one of them already, whose victims were trying to fight free of the tentacles, and moved on to a more distant target. That one died too. The deck gun fell silent. Tolvern and the others sprang to their feet. A ladder descended from the belly of her ship, and voices shouted for her to come up. She grabbed the rungs, joined quickly by others. When she got up, she was greeted by the long, solemn face of Nib Pim. She was so glad to see her pilot that she planted a kiss right where his lips would have been, if he'd had them. He blinked back with his large, liquid eyes.
"I do not understand the significance of you kissing me,"
he said in his high, almost crooning voice.
"But Lieutenant Smythe is waiting for you on the bridge, and he says we should leave at once."
"Good thing Rodriguez is leaving the yards behind," Tolvern said as Smythe informed her of the situation. "Because we don't have time to get onto the tarmac, we're going to trash the hangar and set the whole blasted place on fire. Cap, get the gunnery. I want those birds targeted on the way up. Send those monsters straight to hell."
The plasma engines fired off, and they lifted from the ground, tearing through the hangar, and leaving behind flaming wreckage. Guns targeted the giant birds as they elevated. She'd have liked to swoop over the city and fight whatever landing craft was sending these giant birds down, but there was an Apex fleet in orbit. Blackbeard had to clear the gravity well and make a run for it, and that meant abandoning Samborondon to its fate. The ship shuddered as they fought their way through the turbulent atmosphere that had dumped ungodly amounts of rain on the island. Instruments lit up warnings and advisories. Smythe and Lomelie struggled to manage crashing computer systems, while engineering worked to keep the whole bucket of nuts and bolts from flying apart in a million directions. The overhaul wasn't 100% finished, but it was close enough. Normally, once the final repairs had been completed, they would run tests while still in the yards, make tweaks, perform simulations, and then bring her into orbit. There, they would run another full battery of tests, and take her for a longer test run before declaring her battle-ready. But this was war. There was nothing normal about it. There'd been no time to run diagnostics. Better hope they hadn't overlooked something critical. The next few moments would be the tense ones. The inertia engine hiccuped, and a giant fist first shoved Tolvern into her chair, then tried to fling her at the ceiling. Finally, it worked properly, and gravity returned to normal. The ship broke the cloud cover, still accelerating rapidly. Blackbeard held together. Of course she did. She was a damn good ship. Minutes later, they were in outer space, the curve of the planet below them. From this height, it looked like a single ocean, deep, almost midnight blue. A string of emerald green islands encircled the equator like a jeweled belt, with another ring of islands crowning the northern polar region. The world had two small silver-colored moons, and a neighboring planet gleamed like an enormous red star. Beyond that lay the Milky Way, an endless swath of stars, still so breathtakingly beautiful and peaceful-looking, no matter how many times Tolvern looked at it. The alien fleet swung around the planet and shattered the peace. Four hunter-killer packs jostled for position, like wolves snarling and biting at each other's flanks. The lances dominated in numbers, slender and gleaming gold in reflected sunlight. But there were several of the heavier spears among them. And then, pulling around behind them, the harvester ship. Bigger than a battleship, it resembled an elongated octopus, with a bulbous, warty head that bristled with weapons, and several short stalks on the other end, opened now, to reveal a large inner docking bay. The harvester ship plopped out pod-shaped shuttles, like it was laying eggs on top of the planet. These dropped into the atmosphere, glowing red as they absorbed heat. No doubt they carried more of the giant warrior-gatherer birds, and would fall by the dozens on every island and population center, killing and burning and gathering their gruesome harvest. Silence ruled the bridge for a long moment,
broken only by the tap of Nib Pim's long fingers over his console. Alone among the crew, he continued his work, charting a course to jump away from this doomed system.
"Enough," Tolvern said. "Everyone, move!"
Her words were like a jolt of electricity to the stagnant bridge. Cloaks came up, and the ship angled away from the planet and the Apex fleet. Tolvern kept her eyes glued to the viewscreen while they worked. No sign yet that the enemy had detected them. Other ships burst through the atmosphere, Hrum and human alike. A new stream of refugees. Apex let them go. Maybe a few tens or even hundreds of thousands would escape, for now. But they were little more than fleas jumping off the back of a drowning dog. Millions would remain on the surface, and it was on these that the buzzards would enjoy their unhurried feast. Tolvern thought Blackbeard would slip away with the other refugees. She brought them next to a freighter and matched its lumbering speed. Stay in its shadow, rely on cloaks. They slid past a hunter-killer pack. The lances seemed to sniff at the freighter as it passed, but didn't deviate from course to destroy it.
"All right," Tolvern said, her stomach a bundle of knots. "Time to hit the gas."
Cap sent the order to the engine room. They swiftly pulled away from the freighter and passed between the two moons on their way to deep space. Nib Pim gave the coordinates to carry them to the jump point out of here, back toward where they'd left the Hrum General. Still no sign of pursuit. Tolvern let out a deep breath.
"Oh, no!"
Smythe said from the tech console.
"Now he sends it! Of all times, now!"
"You're babbling, Smythe," Tolvern said. "What is it?"
"A subspace message from Admiral Drake."
"Well, what is it? Don't just sit there gawking. Send it through."
Have inflicted heavy damage on an enemy fleet with modest losses suffered to Royal Navy forces. This was typical understatement on Drake's part, she was sure. No doubt he delivered a crippling blow. But the part about modest losses might also be understated, she kept reading. Under pursuit by an unknown quantity of enemies, seeking rendezvous at agreed-upon location at your earliest possible convenience, AJD. The agreed-upon location meant Sentinel 3. The message had no doubt been sent to the Hrum General, as well as to Captain McGowan, who had been picking his way out from his defense of the homeworlds, leading Peerless at the head of a second fleet.
"What do we do now?"
Smythe asked.
"We'll do our best to obey," she said dryly. "The so-called Dragon Quadrant is a dangerous neighborhood for a lone cruiser, and we might not make it."
"Eh, Captain," Cap said, "I think you're missing the question."
"It's a subspace message, sir," Smythe said.
"I know what it means," she said, watching the viewscreen. "Drake sent a message and Apex no doubt heard. Bad timing, but all we can do is deal with it."
Enemy ships were already moving. Two of the hunter-killer packs split away from the planet.
"We're getting hit by active sensors," Smythe said. "They caught the subspace all right, now they're looking for us."
"They won't see us, right?"
Cap asked. She rubbed her buzzed scalp.
"We're cloaked and Apex sensors are bollocks. Right, Captain?"
"We're about 6 inches away," Tolvern said grimly. "Bollocks or not, I think they'll find us."
"Then we're buggered."
"You could say that," the captain agreed.
"Why did he send it now?" Smythe repeated.
Yes, why now? He could have sent it a week ago, or in 3 days, when she was in the clear. Give her a billion miles to work with, and it wouldn't matter if Apex could temporarily pinpoint her location or not. But here and now? When she was so close, she could feel the enemy's hot breath on her neck as she crept past. Hardly his fault. Drake wasn't one for sending frivolous messages. But the timing couldn't have been worse.
"There we go," Smythe said. "They got us. Their sensors are about as sophisticated as two men banging metal buckets with hammers and listening for the echo. But now that they've fixed on us, they're hitting us regularly. We can't lose them."
The hunter-killer packs flew past the freighter, which still lumbered gamely away from the planet. The freighter made an awkward turn, what passed for an evasive maneuver, which would have been as effective as a giant tortoise trying to dodge a pack of lions. But the lions weren't interested. They kept going, coming straight after the fleeing human warship. The lances were out of weapon range, and Blackbeard was increasing the gap between herself and the pursuing ships. As the two sides built speed, Blackbeard's advantage would only grow, if not for those blasted short-range jumps. It was only a matter of time before the enemy appeared on Blackbeard's flanks. There was nothing left for it now.
Drop cloaks! Bring all weapon systems online!
Back in battle, and the odds were grim. Realistically, non-existent. Tolvern's only hope was to inflict a few blows before she went down with her ship. Chapter 21. For once, Drake awakened quickly after passing a jump point. He shook his head, no more stunned than if he'd stood up too quickly and gone lightheaded. He was giving orders even before the dizziness passed. Drake had suffered a final moment of doubt the instant he approached the jump. It must be another trick. Make him think there was a third hidden enemy fleet in the system, that they'd surround his fleet and annihilate it, trick him into running toward the only jump point out of the system. And what was on the other side? Maybe nothing, maybe the aliens were beaten down, convinced they were going to be destroyed by Dreadnought and her support ships. Apex had finally met its match, and could only hope to trick him into running away. But if that were the case, why hadn't they tried to make a run for it themselves? They could jump ahead of him, stay out of his range indefinitely. The other possibility was that a massive enemy force waited on the other side of the jump point. Lances, spears, even a harvester or two. He would come through stunned, and they'd tear him apart before he could recover. But the area around the jump point was clear.
"Get us away from here," he told his pilots. "Any direction, the rest of our fleet can follow, and we'll plot a new course as soon as we've had a look around. Lloyd, get us cloaked. No long-range sensors, we can't give ourselves away. And somebody find the jump points in this system."
As those wheels set themselves in motion, Drake turned his attention to organizing his forces. Normally, he'd position his corvettes out front. They were the quickest out of the blocks in a scrape, more powerful than a destroyer, and more maneuverable than a cruiser. But Apex's ability to leap into the fray rendered them vulnerable. Instead, he positioned Dreadnought in the vanguard, with his cruisers bringing up the rear. He set a destroyer screen on one side, with the corvettes below and behind. The missile frigates and torpedo boats took a comfortable, protected position above Dreadnought. They were underway, even while the last two cruisers were still jumping through. He took a small risk in leaving them to catch up with the others. Scans brought up more information. This system was a desert. There were two rocky inner worlds, slightly inside and outside the so-called Goldilocks zone, respectively. One, a hot, gas-choked planet. The other, cold enough for carbon dioxide to fall as snow. There might once have been a more promising planet somewhere between their orbits. The huge number of asteroids in wobbly orbits around a yellow-orange star seemed to indicate that something had broken up at one point. They found four jump points in the system. The one they'd just come through was located among the rocky inner worlds. Another was so close to the star that they'd be sweating by the time they approached. It matched no known signature, but appeared quite stable. Another was a wobbly, unstable jump way out past the icy planetoids on the edge of the system. The tech officers estimated its age as less than 2 years, and its eventual decay sometime in the next 6 months, perhaps sooner. It might lead nowhere, or it might drop them inside the gravity well of a neutron star. They could send a probe, but unstable as it was, even if they did jump safely through, they might find that it was a one-way trip. The final jump point fell in an empty region a few million miles outside the orbit of the system's largest gas giant, a massive brown dwarf with several large, almost planet-sized moons. Where did the jump point lead? His tech officers were studying the data coming back from scans, but Drake had low expectation of successfully identifying it, until Ko let out a burst of excited Chinese.
"This signature matches," she said. "Admiral, look at the database from Sentinel-3.
She sent over the information. No charts existed of this system, but there was a ream of data from the Singapore homeworld. And one of the outgoing jump points from Singapore itself was a match for this one. Not identical, but the database was a decade out of date, and even the most stable jump points changed with time.
"How sure are we?" Drake asked. "Give me numbers."
78% confidence, Lloyd said. Not a certainty by any stretch. Nearly one in four chance that it leads somewhere else.
Don't be ridiculous, Ko said after another burst of Chinese, this time spat out, like so many curse words. It has to be the same jump point, it has to.
Hold on, Lloyd said. Refined data coming in from the latest scan.
He hesitated.
Make that only 59%, and a lower degree of confidence in the assessment.
Ko looked more uncertain now. Drake didn't like the odds either. That was barely above 50-50. He wanted a few minutes to consider the options, but events conspired against him. The tech officers had been hammering away with active sensors, looking for another hidden fleet. And Lloyd shouted a new discovery, ahead of them, snugged in near a pair of wandering asteroids in loose orbit around each other, came something with a dull heat signature and emitting radiation. At first glance, it was a massive ship, 3 times the size of Dreadnought. The Apex mothership? No, it was a derelict, a wreck. And not a ship at all, but a battle station. A Sentinel battle station, to be specific. Broken in pieces, destroyed in battle. Ko clenched her fists when it became clear what they were looking at. She dropped her head.
Commander Lee told me there were 11 Sentinels, Drake said. Each one placed at a critical position to protect the home system. I guess that answers the question about our jump point.
Ko lifted her head. So it is Singapore on the other side?
Most likely, yes.
Her tone was mixed bitterness and hope. You know what that means, Admiral. What we have to do, surely you must.
It means that Apex is trying to herd us toward Singapore, he said.
No, it means... Her eyes widened slightly.
Exactly. They've as good as invited the fleet through. Opened a channel for us, invited us to leave, but only to here. And what do we find when we get here? Convenient, isn't it? And what will we get if we jump through to Singapore?
He continued.
A welcoming party, no doubt. We know there's at least one harvester ship in orbit around Singapore, together with a large enemy fleet. There are 2 fleets behind us, and most likely a third. Their strategy seems obvious. Push us through to Singapore and smash us, between the hammer and the anvil.
Or it could be the opportunity to free my planet and save my people.
Without the rest of our forces?
Her brow knit together, and she chewed at a lip as she studied the screen and the data scrolling across it. This time she had no answer for him. Expressions across the bridge showed the same story. Doubts and fear spread from one face to the other.
So we have no choice, Mank said. We can't go back and we can't go forward. We have to stay here and fight it out. Shall I send a message to the other ships?
We do have a choice, Drake said. We have several. Apex plays tricks, and they've got our heads spinning now. Where is the trap? Where are they pushing us? This could be a trick to keep us in the system while they bring their final fleet into play. Well, humans can play tricks, too. And if this is a poker game, we can call their bluff. The enemy won't be guarding the other side of that jump point, he continued. This whole battle has developed too quickly, and until recently the buzzards were trying to destroy us, not push us through. Apex may not be facing a civil war, but it's full of factions. We'll use that against them.
What are you saying, sir? Manx asked.
Give orders to the fleet. We jump through to Singapore. We catch them before they're ready.
It was a gamble, a risk, with the naval resources of the Kingdom of Albion. If he guessed wrong, he'd lose his fleet and his life. But more importantly, Albion would be stripped of her defenses. Nothing would hold Apex back. But war was always a roll of the dice, a spin of the wheel. Life itself was a gamble in this uncertain universe, filled with hostile, expanding civilizations. Many of history's most important battles had turned on a bold gambit, a wrong decision, or a bit of luck. If humanity thought that by taking to the stars, they would change not just the odds, but the nature of the game, they were wrong. They'd fought out their age-old struggles on Earth, only to emerge into a cosmos filled with the same violent conflicts. Human civilization was still young in the universe. Would it continue to grow, or would the human race be devoured by an even more aggressive, hostile species?
On the other end of that jump point lay the answer to his question. Drake ordered his forces toward the jump, determined to take his fleet through and find out.
This is the end of Dragon Quadrant, Book 2 of the Sentinel Trilogy. The story continues now with Book 3 of the Sentinel Trilogy, Shattered Sun.
Chapter 1. The Froom General and his young adjutant stood in the loading bay, eyeing the single-seat spacecraft. It sat on a rail in front of them, waiting to be shuttled to the launch tube, there to be hurled from the sloop of war into space. The adjutant gave a worried whistle through her nose slits.
"Lord General," she said, "I am not sure it's advisable. Very unsafe. Very unsafe indeed."
"Nonsense," Mos Driz said. "A skimmer craft is serviceable to 5 million kilometers, although with the size of that cockpit, I imagine my legs will be in need of a good stretch before I'm through. Perfectly safe, though."
"That is not precisely what I mean. It's the cultists. Once they look at you..."
"Because I am pale and pink instead of purple." Another whistle, but this one turned into a hum that sounded disapproving.
"Yes, Lord General. To be perfectly frank, that is exactly what I mean."
The younger Hroom was Lenel Tin, from one of the most important families in the Empire. Her father was a senator, her mother a cousin of the Empress herself. The Lenel clan, the whole planet of Tin, in fact, prided itself on being free from sugar addiction. Some families had been known to sell their own children to the humans when they fell to the addiction, so as to keep their lineage pure. Now that an antidote was available, injections were mandated by law on the planet of Tin. All Hroom would be inoculated against sugar addiction.
"Listen to me," Mos Driz said. "The cultists have promised me safe passage. You don't think they are lying, do you?"
Lenel Tin flushed deep purple.
"The cultists are as incapable of human-like deception as any Hroom. I would never fear a lie."
"Then you are a fool. Someone is lying in this room. And it isn't you, my young friend."
Anxious that something would tumble out of his mouth, a worry that terrified Mos Driz, even as he was desperate to come clean with his adjutant, he looked over to the skimmer. It was 8 meters long, a sleek, torpedo-shaped craft, wrapped around a pulse engine that gave it quick acceleration, but was incapable of reaching jump speeds. And it was unarmed. If it ever found itself attacked, its only hope was racing for cover.
"It isn't that they're lying, Lord General," Lenel Tin said. "But the cultists are brittle, quick to anger. They loathe humans and have sworn to kill any Hroom who deal with them. When they see your pink skin, they're sure to fly into a rage."
"I am well aware of their devotion to the God of Death, but they must set aside their hatred, must work with me and the humans, or our worlds will bleed and die. The birds will kill us all."
"Then let me take the skimmer. Let me negotiate. You trusted me last time. Trust me again. I've been trained in the art of negotiation. I can do this for you, Lord General. With honor and pride, win them back for the Empress, may she live forever."
Mos Driz rested his palm in the center of Lenel Tin's chest, a gesture that urged trust, a father to a child, a general to his adjutant.
"You are right, my friend. The cultists are brittle. If I send my adjutant, they will see an insult. We will never win them over."
"Then put the High Priestess on the viewscreen first,"
she urged.
"Let the woman see the color of your skin. Get her accustomed to the shock."
"There's no point in that."
"Of course there is. That would guarantee that the cultists won't fly into a rage and tear you apart on first sight."
Friend,
Mose Driz said, tone soothing. Her suggestion was more dangerous than she knew, and he had to dismiss it. Now you are only deflecting. I'm lying, friend. There are no cultists on the planet. Yes, a lie, incomprehensible as that seemed. Lenel Tin would never suspect it, and not only because Hroom didn't lie. That General Mose Driz, of whom she loved and honored, had deceived her, had terrible, dangerous intentions on the other end of this flight, was something beyond her understanding. Mose Driz removed his hand from the young woman's chest. You have 11 sloops, Colonel. It is a great responsibility.
Yes, Lord General.
11 sloops is the largest fleet remaining in the shattered remnants of our once proud race. And the only hope for restoring the dignity of the Hroom people. A seed to plant and cultivate. You understand?
Yes, Lord General.
This time, however, a vibration in Lenel Tin's voice indicated doubt. The size and importance of our fleet is beyond question, is it not? Mose Driz pressed.
Yes, Lord General. But please, would you not consider, before you go...
Her eyes fell to the hip packs belted around the General's waist. Not that again. It is a little bit of sugar. There is no harm.
A quick injection. I know the withdrawal is terrible, but it would be worth it. I have the doctor on hand, and he is experienced with the antidote. There are drugs to take to mitigate the effects, treatments that...
I have no time for that, Mose Driz scoffed. We have a few days to gather these cultists and meet with the other sloops before rejoining the humans. An addiction like mine would take months to overcome, antidote or no. The war will be over by then, one way or another.
It would generate sympathy, show your commitment.
Enough, Colonel. Now listen to me, and listen carefully. If I do not return for any reason, don't try to negotiate with the cultists. Don't attempt to contact them. Take the ships and flee. Find Captain Tolvan. If Admiral Drake sends a subspace, obey him without question. Lenel Tin hesitated. Open the canopy, he told her.
Yes, Lord General.
She obeyed, and Mose Driz climbed the short ladder. Other people in the launch bay stared as he folded his long limbs into the cockpit. The bay also served as the sloop's armory, and workers were stacking the short bomblets of the serpentine batteries in preparation for battle. Most of the workers were Hroom. Their dark, liquid eyes reflected anxiety as they watched the general preparing for his departure. But there were also 3 humans on loan for the Royal Navy. Their expressions were unreadable, and they kept working even as they glanced his way. Humans were cold-weather creatures, and sweat poured down their temples as they fought the climate inside the Hroom ship. Mose Driz almost felt sorry for them. But the general was not fooled. These humans were not merely engineers and technicians, but liaisons, a fancy Albionish term for spies, to watch the Hroom and make sure they did not renege on their agreements. The design of a sloop of war was both different and inferior to that of a human warship, and the humans must worry every moment they were on board a Hroom ship, must wish they were on one of their own destroyers or heavy cruisers. And the bay was the weakest part of a sloop. Thick armor protected the hull outside, but there was only a single inadequate bombproof. Due to some ancient design flaw, the serpentines needed to be armed when they were stacked for loading, ready to go off. If enemy fire penetrated the bay, the resulting explosion frequently burst the hull or shot out through the plasma engines. Either result was catastrophic. That vulnerability had been long known by the humans, who relentlessly targeted this part of a sloop during any engagement. Apex knew it too. At some point, Mose Driz knew, the Empire had had scientists and engineers capable of solving such problems. But that was centuries ago. Now the Hroom were helpless but to continue building the same ship, generation after generation, even as enemies grew and adapted. The Hroom general held up his hand, and the colonel pressed her palm against it. Remember your orders.
Yes, Lord General. May the old gods bless your journey.
And yours. The blessing sounded like blasphemy coming out of the general's mouth, and if he died, he expected to find himself in the Aishiel, where the souls of the wicked, the disbelievers, and the traitors would shiver for all eternity. Some doubted that such a place existed. Not General Mos Driz. One of his wayward brothers often appeared in his dreams, hands shackled in cold iron, a crown of ice around his head, to warn Mos Driz to abandon his wicked ways. Once the canopy was down, Mos Driz checked the instrument panel, while a rail slid the skimmer toward the launch tube. All systems were functional. The small ship glided through a pair of airlocks, and then the outer bay door opened, and he was staring at the black void and an endless swath of stars. A buzz. The skimmer shot forward. The pulse engine engaged, and Mos Driz took the helm and steered toward his rendezvous. He'd left his crew behind, his adjutant, his officers, his crew, down to the lowliest septic worker. Not one of them seemed to suspect that his mission was other than what he'd claimed. Neither did the human observers. A voice whispered in his ear. No, not his ear. This was no message via comlink, but directly into his mind.
Well done, General. You have convinced the fools, one and all.
Horror filled him, and a familiar scratching dug at a spot behind his eyes, like there was an insect in there, a nasty, burrowing parasite that was devouring him from the inside. His hand fumbled at one of his packs, and he brought out a small vial containing carefully measured white grains. Sugar, the food of the gods, the curse of death. He got the stopper off and poured the sugar into a small pile in the middle of his palm. He stared at it for several seconds, then dipped his head and lapped it up. The swoon was immediate, a light, hazy feeling that carried him on wings, even as the stars blurred to a smear outside the canopy of his small ship, and the clawing in his brain subsided.
Chapter 2 8 hours out of Samburondon, and HMS Blackbeard was still alive, still running for her life. Captain Tolvern counted that as a victory. She hadn't expected to live this long, to be honest. The moment the subspace came through from Admiral Drake, the Lancers had stopped sniffing casually at the refugee ships, leaping clear of the doomed planet, and searched eagerly for the fleeing human warship. They found Blackbeard moments later, and Tolvern began to count their continued existence in minutes, not hours. 8 lances against 1 heavy cruiser. It would be a lopsided battle. But instead of attacking, the Lancers were content to follow, even as they fell farther and farther behind. Blackbeard's powerful engines stretched the advantage to 1 million miles, then 2 million. The Lancers could jump